I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Feeling stressed lately? Having trouble getting a good night's sleep? Struggling with weight gain? Are you getting sick a lot? It could be hormonal. While hormones influence so much of our body and brain functions, the word hormone was coined just a little more than a century ago in 1905 after several decades of hit and miss experimentation. Our guest, Randy Hutter Epstein, details the fascinating and groundbreaking history of endocrinology in her new book titled Aroused. It's about the people who did early research involving roosters, jars of brains, vasectomies, and about a mother collecting pituitaries from cadavers to help treat her son, a 500-pound woman named Blanche Gray, the trial of Leopold and Loeb, and the now discredited hormone crime theory. It's also how this research has led to medical advances that have improved all of our lives. Randy Hutter Epstein joins us from the NPR studios in New York. She's a medical writer, lecturer at Yale University, writer in residence at Yale Medical School, and she's an adjunct professor at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Randy Hutter Epstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, I'm thrilled. I guess I'm aroused to be here.
Well, what do you know? Me too. Well, let's start with that word, aroused. Is that a good synonym for hormone?
It's a perfect synonym because in 1905, when two British doctors really came up with this concept, and it was a revolutionary concept of how hormones work. Now, they really just were internal secretions. That's what they were called, but they needed a word. So they did what doctors do. We want highfalutin words, and we sort of tend to go with the Greek. So these two doctors went to their friend, who was a Cambridge University classics professor, and said, we need some word, one word to describe these internal secretions in the body. I want a word for aroused, as in arousing the adrenal gland, arousing the pituitary, arousing, oh, well, he didn't really want to talk about testes or ovaries at the time. But his friend said, well, in Greek, there's a word hormoa. That means to arouse. Why not something along those lines? So that's how we came up with the word hormone. Now, someone else, because doctors never agree on anything. So during this meeting at the Royal Society in London, another doctor was like, I don't know if I want the word hormone. And he suggested autocoid, as in internal drugs, which actually has a cool definition, but then we'd all go around saying, like, oh, my God, I feel so autocoital.
I don't think it works quite as well.
It doesn't work.
This book is full of really fascinating stories, and I want to get to a couple of them. You credit a German doctor, Berthold, with really setting epidemiology on the path. He did some really what seemed kind of bizarre and a little strange, a little weird research involving roosters and castration. Tell us what he did and what he found.
Well, the wonderful thing about Arnold Berthold is that while I just said, you know, that we came up with the word hormone and the whole concept in 1905, like so many things, really the history goes back before that, but everyone ignored it. So the world's first hormone experiment was in 1848, a half a century before the field really took off. And here's what this doctor did. Yep, he was fiddling with roosters and their testicles, something that farmers had done for centuries. But what he did was very different from anybody else ever before. He asked this brilliant question, do these mysterious glands in our body work from no matter where they are? So what he did was he castrated some roosters, and then he put a testicle into the belly of another castrated rooster. So picture this, or you might not want to picture
it. I'm trying to, but go ahead.
Okay, you might not want to picture, but you kind of think about it.
Sure.
There's a castrated rooster, nothing between its drumsticks, but one lone testicle in the loops of its intestines. And voila, right there in this doctor's backyard in 1848, this little rooster, as he described, became the old rooster it used to be, chasing after hens. Its comb got redder. It seemed to be re-energized. So he did one good thing and one not so great thing. He wrote it up in a scientific journal. That's a great thing. And he wrote how he did this very meticulous experiment, albeit in his backyard, not a laboratory. But the one thing he didn't do was sort of understand the ramifications. So he didn't really publicize the results. So his discovery wasn't discovered until 50 years later. And it's remarkable. We take it for granted that, of course, hormones work no matter where they are in the body. But before the 1900s, before we appreciated it, it was thought that every single message in the body marched along like a railroad track, along your nerves. It had to be attached. Your hormones are like your internal Wi-Fi. It's really an amazing concept when you think that the pituitary in the brain can spout a teeny bit of a chemical, and the chemical knows right where it is to go, right where it goes. That's why when we take like insulin shots for people with diabetes, you don't have to get the insulin right into your pancreas. The insulin knows where to go.
Well, and even just picking up on Dr. Berthold's experiment, when he removed the testicles, the rooster's behaviors changed. I guess they became more like hens. But once the testicles were attached to the stomach, they acted more like roosters.
Exactly. And, you know, farmers had done this before. Farmers have been castrating cattle and doing things and noticing that when they castrated them, they seemed to gain weight. They seemed slower. But no one ever thought, I'm not even sure why Dr. Berthold thought, hey, let's put this testicle somewhere else. But he did. And by doing so, he helped launch the field of endocrinology.
And he knew what he was, when he wrote it up, he knew what he had observed or what he had found?
Oh, absolutely. He wrote it up. It's meticulous. It was in a scientific German publication. But then I don't think he realized, wow, I'm launching a new field. He just wrote up this finding. This gland works no matter where it is in the body. And then he just went off and, I guess, went to see patients and did whatever else he did.
Well, let's do just a little lesson for all of us about our glands and hormones and how that works. So we have 9 glands in our body. And the job of a gland, as you write, is to secrete hormones. Sounds very simple, but not simple at all. Help us understand that interaction.
Well, what we know is that, right, the glands in your body secrete hormones. And as I say, that's simple. What hormones do are not as simple. They come in teeny, tiny little packets. They're just tiny bits that are potent, and they tap on cell receptors. At the time when we first discovered, we weren't thinking cell receptors, but we knew they were targeted like a well-aimed bow and arrow. When they get to their destination, depending on where they're going, depending on the type of hormone, that's what affects our bodies in terms of growth, in terms of mood. What makes the picture that much more complicated is the interaction of all these hormones. So we tend to think of hormones when we think growth hormone or insulin or testosterone or estrogen, we might have this image in our head of sort of runners taking off on a racetrack. Everyone has their own lane. But really, it's more a cobweb. They're all attached. So we know that growth hormone affects estrogen and testosterone and insulin. They all affect each other. And that's what the wonderful thing that endocrinologists do is they have this appreciation of not just the single hormone, but all how they affect each other and how they affect our immune system.
Let me quote something you wrote in the book, because I think it's just a wonderful description about the process of growing or the growth hormone. You write, "The whole process of growing depends on Swiss clock timing and a master chef's attention to detail. It's like baking a cake. You can measure all the right quantities of egg, sugar, butter, and flour. But if you don't know how to mix them together and you forget to turn on the oven, you'll end up with one set dessert," which I think is such a wonderful description about sort of the mystery, the marvel of how these hormones work and how our life really depends on it.
Absolutely. And that's one metaphor I could really relate to, because I do like to bake a lot.
Oh, do you?
Sometimes
I was wondering about that.
Yeah. When I describe hormones as your internal Wi-Fi, I think that also is a good metaphor. but I actually can't turn on my television, and I have no idea how Wi-Fi works. So I know hormones, but I don't know Wi-Fi, but I do know baking.
Fair enough. And I get it on the TV part. I don't know how to turn on my TV at home either. But you mentioned testosterone. Another thing you write in this book is that testosterone and estrogen are really fraternal twins. And we tend to think of them, as you say, on two different highways. But really, they interact with each other and they have a lot in common. Can you expand on that?
Yes. I mean, it's really a misnomer. We know that men have more testosterone than women. Women have more estrogen, but everyone has both. And even when testosterone was named, so it was named for the shape of the molecule, rhone, that goes to the shape, but from the testes, but your adrenal glands also produce testosterone. So there were doctors saying, oh, no, we can't go with this name because then it's going to imply that only the testes makes testosterone, only men have testosterone. But it became testosterone, and we have a lot of misconceptions about, you know, female hormones versus male hormones. We now know there's more of a spectrum. We all have both. And they also can convert into one another. So it's more of a chain reaction. We also know there's this myth, even in men, that if your testosterone is too low, it means your estrogen is going up, like some kind of seesaw. And even in a recent study in New England Journal of Medicine, it was shown, no, actually in some men with lower testosterone, their estrogen was lower too. So it's not this seesaw thing of girl versus boy.
Well, while we're talking about testosterone, about a minute or so before our first break here, you also say that there are daily fluctuations when it comes to testosterone. And we tend to fixate on numbers, but you're saying, and perhaps we shouldn't be surprised by this, but there's a lot of up and down as the day progresses.
Yes, that which means that men are hormonal too. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that just a wonderful
thought? It's not just us, right?
It's not just us. Their testosterone is going up and down. And that's why for men who are worried if they're low testosterone, really need two blood tests taken at the same time, read by an accredited lab, rather than just one random blood test in the middle of the afternoon.
And is there kind of an ebb and flow throughout the day when it comes to testosterone?
There is an ebb and flow throughout the day, just the way that we know there is for other hormones. And that's why, again, you know, you want your levels taken at the same time.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about hormones in this hour of Radio Times. And our guest is Randi Hutter Epstein. She's got a new book. It's titled Aroused, subtitled The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. She's a medical writer. She's a lecturer at Yale University, writer in residence at Yale Medical School, and she's an adjunct professor at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. We want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I should add that Randi Hutter Epstein has an MD, but she's not a practicing physician. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Randi Hutter Epstein about hormones and the fascinating history of endocrinology. Randi, let me ask you about a woman that you write about. It's a chapter titled The Fat Bride. Her name was Blanche Gray. She weighed something like 517 pounds at her death. What does her story tell us about hormones?
Well, I like to think of her story as sort of the prequel to hormones. She was born and died in the late 1800s before we had the word hormone, before we understood anything about it. But what she represents is a time period, a kind of awful time period in American history where people who were considered very different, the bearded lady, the fat lady, even horribly so, there was someone, the armless wonder. People who were physically different were hired to be in the circus all across the eastern seaboard. They were just put on display to be gawked at. At the same time, there were some doctors saying, this is awful. We think that maybe some of these people, such as the fat bride who I write about, or the bearded lady, They should not be gawked at in the circus. They may have a gland problem. I write about the fat bride because it's more complex than the doctors being the good guys and the circus people being the bad guys. The doctors weren't really helping or curing these people. They needed them as almost laboratory guinea pigs. They had no idea what was going on, but they wanted their bodies. I mean, I would like to say they wanted their bodies dead or alive, but they kind of wanted their bodies dead so they could cut them open and look at their glands and see if it was shrunken or too big. And maybe that would give a clue to what these glands do in the first place.
21st century, then, not obviously people, all people of that level of obesity. But do we know more about some people's, I guess, insatiable appetites or their inability to lose weight or their ability to seem to put on weight?
We do. In the 1990s, we had this wonderful discovery of a new hormone that we call leptin. It's sort of your I'm not hungry anymore hormone, your appetite hormone. We now know that some people, it's pretty rare, but some people have a defect either in leptin or a defect in its pathway or a defect in the way our body responds. And there are some people, I spent a few days with a little boy who has a defect. They are insatiably hungry. Wow. They never feel full, and they almost have this compulsion to keep eating. What this has shown us is two things. One is it's really giving a clue to how hormones control behavior. This is not about getting fat because of a metabolism issue, because you pack on the calories more. This is controlling your behavior in a way that you're just compelled to keep wanting to eat. You're obsessed with the thought of food. It also shows, and it's starting to show, the details of this leptin pathway. There are some drugs in the pipeline. There are some shots for some people with certain defects in leptin that have really made them more hormonally balanced. Fascinatingly so, one young man in England who's on a trial now for a drug that might be helping his leptin defect, told a friend that he enjoys food for the first time in his life. He had never enjoyed food. He was just compelled to keep eating.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for the rest of us,
yeah.
There's no little pill that we can take just to take off those 5 pounds or just to, like, get us from putting our hand in the cookie jar.
Because, as you say, these are relatively rare cases. You mentioned the fact of a new hormone, leptin. So how many hormones are there as of today?
Oh, you know, there's so many. You know, we tend to think, like, there's 8, the ones that we sort of talk about. Oh, progesterone, estrogen. But there's so many. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of hormones in terms of, because we're realizing it's not just those big ones that we talk about, but the little helper ones along the way. And there's hormone releasers. Those are hormones, too. Hormones that tell other hormones to be released. So there's hundreds. But in terms of leptin, it is showing us, yes, that our appetite is controlled by hormones. But again, there's other hormones that probably for most of us control our appetite too. And then this might come as a surprise, but some of us sometimes eat even when we're not hungry. Maybe we're stressed. Maybe we think we need it as a reward. So it's kind of hard just to sort of take a pill that's going to just calm our appetite.
Well, you mentioned stress, and that gets us to cortisol, right?
Yes.
How does that work?
So, you know, it's interesting. Cortisol is known as the stress hormone, but it's also involved with so many other things, with blood pressure. My grandmother, turned out, had a cortisol issue, and it's called Addison's disease, the same one that John F. Kennedy had. So I like to say when I was little, and I knew she had something because my mother said, don't forget to take your cortisone pills. Mm-hmm. So, but I don't think I thought it was hormones, because when I was little, hormones was just like boobs and sex and puberty.
all the good stuff, right?
All the good stuff. And I kind of thought it was like a very presidential thing to catch that my grandma had the same thing as John F. Kennedy. But now we know a few things. We know that, right, cortisol is, it helps with, you need it for your immune system. it is a stress hormone, but it's also a stress hormone not just in feeling anxious. It's a stress hormone that when you're undergoing surgery, for instance, that puts your body in stress, a different kind of stress, but you need that stress then to increase cortisol to help your body heal from the surgery. So it's stress in sort of a bigger use of the word stress.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Randi Hutter Epstein, and we are talking about hormones on Radio Times today. She has written a new book called Aroused, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. We are walking through some of the hormones, including cortisol and testosterone. We'll be talking about some others as well. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. I quoted you, Randi, about how growth hormones work, this really sort of magical thing that has to happen in order for us to grow. And you talk about growth hormones as sort of what everything that could go right and could go wrong in trying to understand how this hormone works. And you describe a mother, a woman named Barbara Balaban, who collected pituitary glands to try to help her son. What was she doing and why?
Oh, she's wonderful. She actually spent a few days with her. So let's go back to the 1960s. When her son was diagnosed with being deficient in growth hormone, this goes back to the times where we couldn't really measure hormones. So it was done, it was a little bit of guesswork. And originally in those days, if people thought you weren't going to be tall enough, which was thought of as like the worst thing for a boy. In the 1960s, there were magazine articles talking about the inferiority complexes of boys who weren't tall. They'd never get married. No one would want to hire them. So Barbara Balaban took her son, he was about 7 or 8, semi-reluctantly to see a specialist. She wasn't that worried at first. But then the specialist said, you know, you might want to do some hormone therapy. Some boys who were too short were taking testosterone. Her doctor knew because her doctor, Dr. Sobel, had done the study that showed that, no, testosterone doesn't work. It might speed your growth for some boys, but you just get to the finish line sooner. It's not going to make you taller than you would have been. They also tried thyroid hormone, but that didn't work either. But there was one thing in the 60s that was new. Growth hormone was a new concept then. They had just gleaned it. They had also just learned that unlike insulin, you couldn't just get growth hormone from a cow or a pig and give it to a human. It had to be human growth hormone given to other humans. You get human growth hormone from the pituitary gland. You have to get it from the pituitary gland of a dead person.
Wow.
So think about this. Barbara Balaban is at the doctor's office in the Bronx in New York with her son, and her doctor said, are you willing to try human growth hormone? And she said, sure, I'm willing to try it. And the doctor said, well, we don't have supplies yet, so if you can collect pituitaries and bring them back, we can get the growth hormone for you. At the time, they thought you needed one pituitary for one shot, and you might need a shot every day. So that's 365 pituitaries or 365 dead bodies for a year of treatment.
And what did she do?
Yeah. Well, Barbara Balaban's wonderful. As she said, this was the 60s. She had already marched against the Vietnam War. She was a real sort of rabble-rouser in her town in Long Island. She started contacting every single pathologist she knew, every surgeon. She wrote them letters. This was not one blast email. These were typed letters that she shoved in envelopes and sent out across the country. And let's just say that after a while of doing this, within, a few months, she became one of the nation's leading collectors of pituitary glands, third only to the National Institutes of Health and the Veterans Administration.
In fact, you include a picture here of the two pretty giant jars filled with pituitary glands.
Yes. I mean, she kept them in her laundry room.
Of course.
In nail polish remover, acetone. That's what kept them. You could mail the pituitaries, just pop them in, which she did, like a little poster board container. And what she said, which really made me feel, wow, my mom would love this. What was the key to Barbara Balaban's success? She said she wrote a thank you note to every single doctor that gave her a pituitary with a nice note in addition to the thank you note about her son, which encouraged them to send more. So I think one of the moral lessons here is write that thank you note, a handwritten one.
I'm all about thank you notes, as my friends and family know. So what happened with her son?
So her son did grow to become about 5'6". He actually hated the treatment. They were painful shots. He didn't want them. There were awful, horrible checkups then. Again, we're talking about a time when he was younger that you couldn't just draw blood and measure your hormone level. So in the beginning, when Barbara would take her son to the doctor, he would have to get naked and they would measure everything on him to see if he was growing. Even his penis, they measured his penis. This poor kid really hated the process. But the parents felt they were doing the right thing and said, when you're 17, you'll be old enough to decide if you want to keep doing it. And as soon as he turned 17, he said, that's it. I'm done with these shots.
And I think this notion that if you're a 5'5" or a 5'6" man, somehow you're not going to make it in this world. I think we've done away with that theory.
I hope we've done away with that theory. I hope we've done away with a lot of our awful theories that started with those circus freaks to make people feel that if you look that different, you're going to have trouble in the world. I think the world had to change so that we can say, no, let's be more accepting for people that, you know, might be a little taller or shorter or whatever. It has no impact. It should have no impact on how people fit in.
Well, you also have a chapter about hormones and gender identity. And this is a sad story, I have to say, about a baby born named Brian Arthur Sullivan. This was back in the 1950s with his genitalia, I guess, neither male nor female at that point.
Right. Now, this is a lot more common than people realize. I mean, there's a huge spectrum of people that we call intersex or born with genitalia that doesn't look completely conventionally male or conventionally female. Some of the statistics, depending on what goes into this category, says 1 in 2,000. Obviously, it's not something that everyone you meet wants to talk about, but it is more common than you think. I write about Beau Laurent, who was born Brian Sullivan, because this person was born probably at, one of the worst times to be born in some ways with ambiguous genitalia, because in those days, the thinking was up until the age of 18 months, gender was completely malleable. That is, if you were born with ambiguous genitalia and the doctor said, let's raise this newborn as a boy. And then by the time you were 18 months, which happened to Bonnie, they said, actually, we made a mistake. We just did some exploratory surgery. This child that we thought was a boy, which happened to Brian, then Bonnie, this child that we thought was a boy has ovaries and a uterus. So here's what you do. He's only 18 months. Throw out all his toys. Get rid of all his clothes. Buy girly things. Think pink. Buy him a doll. Change his name. He's less than 18 months. Everything will be okay. He's still a clean slate. Start calling him a she.
Doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that way. We also thought in the 50s that you needed emergency surgery in order so that your genitalia could look completely like the way that we think they're supposed to look. It's really, for some people, this surgery was cosmetic surgery. There was no medical need for it. But it could be very damaging, especially for girls who they thought, you know, that they had to cut away, which cut away a lot of nerves, which affected a lot of women's sexual feelings.
In fact, you're right, and this is very poignant. After raising him for a year and a half, Mrs. Sullivan, that would be his mother, missed her son. She felt as if the baby she had birthed no longer existed. One moment, she was the mother of a beautiful baby boy. Then nearly 18 months later, the doctors were telling her it was a case of mistaken identity. I mean, yes, we understand a lot more now, but it seems a fair amount of suffering, certainly when it came to this particular case and cases like it.
It's a lot of suffering. There's a lot of people today that are very resentful about how the doctors treated them, and they're resentful about how their parents went along with the doctors. But we have to realize that in the 50s and 60s, your doctors were the experts. Most of them were men. They told you what to do, and you listened. I don't think any parents were thinking, you know, oh, this is some weird experiment, and I'm not thinking carefully about this. They were really doing what they thought was best for their child, and the experts told them so. So when Mrs. Sullivan brought her 18-month-old for a checkup because things just didn't seem right, the doctors at Columbia University at the time said, you know, give us your son, come back in a week. And when they came back, they said, oh, actually, you know, he wasn't a boy. And by the way, now we think he's a girl. The clitoris looked too big, so we removed the whole thing.
Wow.
And, you know, just start here. Sign this paper. We'll get a new birth certificate. So it was tragic all around for everyone. And Brian, who became Bonnie, was never told her story. When she finally got her medical records when she was in her 20s, and she begged doctors, I want to see my medical records, because she was worried that there was something being hidden from her. She opened up her medical records and she saw it said hermaphrodite, true hermaphrodite. She was horrified. We don't use that word anymore,
no,
fortunately.
Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Randi Hutter Epstein, our guest on Radio Times. Her book is called Aroused, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. Lots we have been talking about. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Randi Hutter Epstein, joining us from the NPR studios in New York. She's a medical writer, lecturer at Yale University, writer in residence at Yale Medical School, and an adjunct professor at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Her new book is called Aroused. She also wrote a book a couple of years ago called Get Me Out, A History of Childbirth from the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank. You can join our conversation. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Picking up on Brian Arthur Sullivan, who became Bonnie Grace Sullivan, help us understand then with a developing fetus how these hormones that we have inside of us, how they work on our development. Do we know?
We do know. I mean, we know that when we're first created, you know, we all look alike. We all just look a little bit like a little, well, we look like a little sphere that stretches out into something that looks like a croissant. And then it looks, I don't know, we look more like a little lizard, I guess, in the body as we're forming. But in those first 6 weeks, we all look alike. As one doctor said years ago, we're all born hermaphrodites, huh. As in we all have the potential to go either way. Again, we don't use that word anymore. But what happens is during those first six, in around the sixth week, a hormone called anti-Müllerian hormone kicks in. And that leads to the development of what we consider male genitalia, and then it prevents the formation of female genitalia. So we know that there are things that then lead, and now we think that there's also signals from the ovary in babies that are born with an ovary that sends signals also hormonal for the development. It's really such a complex time when you think that there's potential to go either way in terms of genital anatomy, that it's amazing that we have, that so many of us fit into what we consider the norm. Go ahead.
Finish your thought.
I was going to say that we also think, but we don't know exactly, that there are hormone signals in the brain at that time, too, in the brain before we're born, that probably set about molding gender identity. We don't know what exactly those signals are, but typically the brain signals match what the anatomy signals are. Sometimes they don't. We don't exactly know what goes on, but we do know that there are people born with an external appearance that appears one gender, but down deep, right, they truly feel a different gender.
It's such an interesting and, again, sort of mysterious process that creates all of us. Let me see what looks like Bruce from Horsham has to say. And Bruce, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I'm curious about the endorphins, the pleasure-producing hormones. You discussed the cortisol, but if somebody engages in grateful thinking or is in a pleasurable environment, what hormones are released, and how easy is for somebody to induce those hormones by shifting your thoughts to a positive angle?
Sure, Bruce, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Randy, can you take that?
Yeah, you know, it's a fascinating question and something that I wish we had really definite answers to. We do know from circumstantial evidence, you know, people say after I go for a run, after a walk in nature, we know from some animal studies and studies that are looking at addiction, this dopamine rush that we say leads to some kind of happiness, and then maybe that also has to do with this rush from addiction. We know that people with Parkinson's that have problems with dopamine, that it doesn't only just affect movement, but it can also affect their mood and low levels depression. But in terms of that one-on-one correlation, so many of these studies, we would need to really go into the human brain. And there's some imaging studies that can see things shot up, but we don't have those details yet. You know, I said to one of the researchers, I can become a little bit fixated on doing jigsaw puzzles. I'm convinced when one piece fits into another that I just get a rush of some hormones and I'm addicted to try to get that other piece. I was asking someone, is that my dopamine? Is that some sort of endorphin?
Right.
I'm not ready to do a brain biopsy of myself to actually find out. So those minute-to-minute sort of things to know what exactly. It's probably more of a stew. It's probably more of a chemical stew that has to do with your dopamine, it has to do with cortisol, and so it's hard to say. And because of that, we haven't quite figured out, while we know hormones control us, we haven't quite figured out how we can control everything. Though we do know that there's definitely physical, chemical changes within us, yes, if we do physical activity. If we go off and sort of shut out from other things and walk in nature, there is probably changes in this chemical stew. But exactly from 1 5 minutes to the next, we're not exactly sure how that's working.
Thanks, Bruce, for the call to Radio Times. Can we say the same thing about oxytocin, which is often called the love hormone or the trust hormone or the bonding hormone, the social hormone? How mysterious is that?
Less mysterious than we would think. Of course, there's still some unknowns. You can actually, I don't recommend this, but you can buy things called liquid trust. It's supposed to be an oxytocin spray. You might want to know that if you buy these things online, they haven't gone through the FDA. So maybe there is some oxytocin in there. Maybe there isn't. This is what we know about this wonderful hormone. We know that it's the hormone that squeezes the uterus to get the baby out. And that's why we have the drug Pitocin for some women who are having trouble. You know, they'll say, let's speed this up. We know that it's the hormone that gets your breast milk flowing. We also know from studies that have been done in goats and rats that it is the mother-baby bonding hormone. It's chemical, that why we just bond to our babies right away. When a doctor in the 1950s blocked oxytocin in the brain when a goat was giving birth, this goat mom headbutted her little kid. She just didn't have that mother-baby bonding. From those seeds, from those pearls of, wow, this hormone has something to do with bonding, it's been extrapolated. We think that maybe oxytocin has something to do with socialness. It has something to do with bonding, Some doctors think it has something to do with enhancing feelings we already have. So that could enhance trust. It could also enhance mistrust. We know right now that if you take a puff of oxytocin, we are not sure how much is getting into your brain. Mm. So while there's fascinating research now going into looking at mice brain and seeing oxytocin in the left temporal lobe and looking at that things that we might hear might affect oxytocin, which affects bonding, I would say that if, as some people say, if you're going to a bar and you're going to buy some oxytocin spray because you want the guy next to you to bond with you, I would say rather than spend your money on this oxytocin liquid trust spray, you might just want to spend your money buying the guy next to you a drink and just kind of being a little more social.
Right. To actually be social versus taking some kind of a hormone to make you feel social.
Exactly.
Let me give testosterone's fraternal twin some equal time here and talk a bit about estrogen. And you talk about some of the early days of the birth control pill, and of course PMS and hormones. And you also include a quote. Again, I'm going to read from your book. This is a book that was published in 1968 called Feminine Forever, a book by Dr. Robert Wilson. And he said, basically telling women to take estrogen, and he says, no woman can escape the horror of this living decay. If a woman's body is furnished through pills with the needed estrogen no longer supplied by her ovaries, her rapid physical decline in postmenopausal years is halted. Her body maintains its relative youthfulness as a man's does. That was 1968. What can we say in 2018?
Okay, well, we can also say that Robert Wilson, whose bestseller book that promoted estrogen, was funded by three estrogen drug makers.
There you go.
He kind of didn't publicize that. Here's what we now know, that we've really studied this a lot. We now know that for women who have not had a hysterectomy, you know, they usually say a woman with a uterus, but that always kind of sounds so funny to me. Yeah. A woman who has not had a hysterectomy, taking estrogen alone can increase the risk of uterine cancer, endometrial cancer. So for those women, that's why it's estrogen plus progesterone. The progesterone protects from uterine cancer. We now know that there's been scares. It's been, hormone replacement therapy is the best. It's the worst. It's the best. The most recent guidelines say to women, if you are troubled with hot flashes, and I can tell you for those people who have not had one, from interviewing experts and being a menopausal woman myself, we're not talking a flash of heat because I can take 95-degree weather. We're talking this internal furnace in your body going up, and it's this claustrophobic, panicky, get me out of here feeling. If you are troubled by that, as so many of us are, if you're waking up every hour, if you have painful intercourse and you're just feeling there's like a dryness that you feel after menopause. We now know that for women, the combination of low doses, lower than we used to give, of estrogen and progesterone, or you can take estrogen alone if you've had a hysterectomy, that does relieve a lot of these symptoms for women. There also, the new guidelines are saying you can be on these hormones for longer than we used to think. It used to be just go on them and get off in a year or two. Now doctors are saying you can go on them, you can take a patch, there's other ways to get your hormones. Do not take them thinking they're going to make you live forever, you'll never get dementia, you'll never get Alzheimer's, you're never going to get a heart disease. In the past, it was thought that this was going to be the cure-all for everything. What the hormone therapy replacement is for the symptoms of menopause, not any sort of miraculous cures for anything else.
So do we, in the case of women talking about estrogen, are we outliving then our hormone supply?
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. I mean, it's an interesting thing. They think, some scientists say, that the only other mammal that suffers from menopause is the killer whale, which is kind of a weird sort of
it
thing.
It sure is.
Yeah, I felt like a killer whale at times in perimenopause. And for women out there listening, it's not so much the menopause that makes you feel awful. It's the insidious perimenopause. You think menopause in your 50s, but you're eking into it in your mid-40s and wondering why you're crankier and, you know, feeling different than you ever felt before. So are we outliving? Someone recently did ask me, what's the evolutionary point of this? I would like to think more in terms of the ebb and flow, that we had these ebb and flows of the menstrual cycle for the point of making babies. And I wouldn't call it outliving, but living beyond the years of baby making into a still more high quality life.
Is there a difference between the natural hormones, the ones that we produce ourselves, and synthetic hormones?
Well, here's how I like to think of it. People have been asking me a lot about bioidenticals and bioidentical compounded. So bioidentical just means matches the chemistry in your body. So there are some hormones that are made in a lab and that work sort of the same way. They tap into the same receptors, but they're not really chemically exactly the same. But there's also hormones made by big drug companies that are bioidentical. They match the chemistry of the hormone in your body. And some doctors feel that those have fewer side effects and they work better. But compounded is different. You know, some women have heard the term, you know, bioidentical compounded put together. Bioidentical matching the same chemistry, that's fine, and that's made by big drug companies do that. Compounded is a whole different ball game. It's sort of a funny process. Years ago in the 80s, compounded hormones meant, for whatever reason, you can't take the drug company's drug. Perhaps you're elderly and can't swallow a pill. So a pharmacist will get the ingredients, make it into a syrup so you can drink it. Someone in the 90s, I guess, had a great idea of, why don't we market these compounded hormones as sort of the healthier version, like the mom and pop shop homemade hormones. But let's think about this. Some of these compounding companies are now just as big as Big Pharma. Yet, because of a loophole in the law, these compounded hormones don't have to go through quality approval. So you really don't know what you're getting. So for women that say, I need to be on a compounded hormone because I want to fiddle with the doses, there's actually so many doses available in hormones that have gone through quality control for both the level of the dose that's in them and also to make sure there's no contaminants. So unless there's some real reason, allergy or some real reason that you need to do the compounded route, I would say you might do your best sticking with something that's gone through some quality control. There have been some scares with contaminants. There was a report of someone with bacterial meningitis from a compounded hormone. There's been studies to show that they don't have the exact dose that was on the label. So you're sort of, it's a little buyer beware.
Well, we're going to end on that note. Randi Hutter-Epstein, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate the time.
Absolutely. She's a medical writer. She's a lecturer at Yale University, writer in residence at Yale Medical School, also an adjunct professor at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, and she writes books, the newest one called Aroused, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. We also had help from Joyce Lieberman, our engineering supervisor here at WHYY. Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern produce Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.